Morning. Morning. It's December 23rd, and it's 15 below outside, and you're at a Zen Center.
Not the 23rd.
Did I say 23rd? 31st. Is it really New Year's Eve, you guys?
Yeah.
Even more bonus points for all of you than I thought. It's New Year's Eve. It is. I was thinking this morning, not during Zazen, about how arbitrary. I just think it's funny. We've just collectively decided as a culture that 2018 makes sense right now. But that number, somehow something started 2,800 trips around the sun ago. So I just think it's funny. We make stuff up and live by it. Sounds like your life, I suppose. Holy cow. So, Happy New Year. Another trip around the sun. Another trip around the sun. That's a funny thing we do. Yeah, it's a funny thing we do. We live in this big floating ball. It's spiraling around another floating ball, and the ball spins, and then we spin on top of that. Sort of a dance of circles, I suppose. So this morning I want to talk about a koan from the Gateless Gate. And part of the reason I chose this is because for a lot of folks in our culture, because we've decided arbitrarily that this is the beginning of a new year and we have the new number and the whole big blah, 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 it's a time for beginnings. People oftentimes try to make some sort of commitment to change or some sort of big step at the beginning of the new year. It's a big transitional time, so we tend to look past and we tend to look future and sort of take evaluation in stock and figure out what's working for us, what we want to continue, and figure out what hasn't worked so well that we want to change. Right? Times of transition. So there's a very famous Zen koan that a lot of you know very well. Some of you won't, so I'll read it to you. But it's about how to take a big step, how to make a change when a change is necessary, and especially how to make a change when a change is necessary and seems impossible. So the koan is from the Gateless Gate. It's number 46 for those of you following along at home. Master Xishuang asked, "How can you proceed on from the top of a 100-foot pole?" So there's your koan. This is one of the ones that isn't a dialogue, it isn't an exchange, it's just a question. How do you proceed on from the top of a 100-foot pole? One pretty well-known Zen teacher responded to this koan by saying, "One who sits on the top of a 100-foot pole has attained a certain height, but still is not handling Zen freely. They should proceed on from there and appear with their whole body in all parts of the world." One who sits on the top of a 100-foot pole has attained a certain height, but still is not handling Zen freely. They should proceed on from there and appear with their whole body in all parts of the world. I kind of get that. If you've made your way to the top of a 100-foot pole, well done you, 100 feet. It's kind of a thing. Feels like an achievement. Pretty good. But if you're sitting at the top of a 100-foot pole, you're sort of stuck. It's kind of hard to go forward, backward, side, or side. You're in this little tiny space. A little tiny space. They're not handling Zen freely. I really like that turn of phrase. Are you handling Zen freely? That's just a way of saying, are you handling your life freely? You know, has your attainment trapped you? Has that happened to any of you? I worked so hard. I got the degree. I applied. I went to all the interviews. I got the job. I've got it. And now I'm stuck. I'm in it, but I'm not in it freely. It feels like a burden. I feel trapped. Muman's verse in the Gateless Gate reads, The one who lacks the third eye of insight will cling to the measure of the 100 feet. Such a person will jump from there and kill themselves, like the blind leading the blind. They cling to the measure of the 100 feet. They cling to the attainment. It's time for a big step, but they're unable to take it because they're clinging. This thing that they have done. The blind leading the blind. Do you think Mumon stole that from Jesus? I don't know. I just think the blind leading the blind is interesting that that metaphor comes up in other traditions. So anyway, how do we proceed on from the top of a 100-foot pole? So it's New Year's Eve, which this year is coming on the 31st, not the traditional 23rd. It's part of change. We have to roll with it. So you are at the top of a 100-foot pole called 2017, and you're about to make a big step. How do you proceed on? How do you proceed on? So I'm going to talk about this koan using the doorway of a poem from Rumi. A lot of you who've heard me talk know he's one of my very favorites. There's something about the way he writes. It reminds me a little bit of Dogen in a way because he mixes didactic teaching with poetic imagery oftentimes. And he moves so freely back and forth between the two that I kind of tend to forget as a reader whether I'm reading an artistic expression of experience or some sort of very specific life instruction I'm supposed to be following. And I like not knowing. I think that's really cool. And also, actually, I have a tendency to trust art as an expression of the human experience a little more than I trust analysis. Right? I think our imagination says more true things about the universe than our left frontal cortex does sometimes. So I really like his work. The other reason I really like him is because he never, ever, to me, comes across as being... I don't know. He never sounds like he's in a one-up. I never feel like I'm talked down to. And a lot of teachers and famous writers can sort of come across that way. Like, I have something I'm going to bestow upon you. Blech, I don't like that. So I really appreciate the lack of ego in his words. I always feel when I'm reading him like he's sitting next to me and we're figuring out together. Not that he... Does that sort of make sense? That there's some sort of... There's nothing sticky. In my heart, anyway, when I read him, there's really nothing sticky about his words. And I don't know how much of that is actually his writing, which I think would have probably been done in Farsi, and how much of it's actually the word choice of the translators. But anyway, the poem that's on the front of your program this morning is 4 very short stanzas from Rumi that I... for me, anyway, as I've chanted this for a number of months now, speak to me of mindfulness, of physicality, of purity, and of courage. And in my own experience, the top of the 100-foot pole, the place from which I know something needs to happen, but the place where I get caught, where I get trapped, is a place of fear and uncertainty. And I need something. I need something to move me from that place. And in the Zen tradition, our faith, which is a word we sometimes use, I guess, we use the word trust too, is always expected to be a verified faith based on our own experience, right? Our actual felt experience of being alive. So when we ask Zen students, like, what's in your storehouse? What's in your toolbox? What can you rely upon? They're going to answer something that they have themselves experienced to be true. Does that make sense? Not an idea, right, that they haven't necessarily experienced, or a theory about something. No, in my own bones, in my own muscles, in my own heart, I've experienced this, you know. And mindfulness and faith and physicality is something that comes up tremendous amount in Zen. I'm going to talk about both those things. But his themes here of purity and courage, I think, are really, really relevant just as humans. They seem like really human things. And Mahayana Buddhism has its own sort of take on these things that I want to touch on real quick, because I think all these things have helped me take the next big step. I hope that this is of some use to you too. But again, these koans and these poems are offerings, and your feelings, your responses, what they speak to you is much more true than anything I'm going to say. So enter into them the way that they they're asking you to. So let's recite this together. It'll be fun for me to hear this spoken with a bunch of voices. I'm used to only hearing me say it, but can we just recite this quick Rumi poem together? This mud body is clear epiphany. Angels wish they could move as I move. Purity, cherubim babies long for my innocence. Courage, armies of demons flee my uplifted hand. Oh, thank you. Ooh, that was just lovely. So now the poem belongs to you. It was not written 800 years ago by a Persian. It was just recited by you, the warm air leaving your lungs, your voice in this room today. So he's not writing about Rumi. And everybody knows that. This is you. This is your voice. He was kind enough to write it down for you a while ago, and somebody else was kind enough to translate it for you. But this is you. Okay, this is you writing this. That's why, it's one of the reasons we chant, to hear the teachings coming out of our own voice, out of our own mouth, out of our own lungs, out of our own body, helps us to relate to them in a different way, and stop that sort of separation of, oh, some really smart guy a long time ago wrote this thing down. No, this is, it has to be you. It has to be you, right? You've got to own it in that way. So after a while, we don't even need to attribute this. Oh, Rumi once wrote, nope. This is mine. No. Has it ever happened to you, like with a poem or song or something that you've quoted so many times that it stops being theirs, that you're quoting? It's just yours now. It's just yours. This is one of those. Isn't that nice? He wrote that poem for you. You wrote that poem for you through him 800 years ago. You're a time traveler. So I think the first little line here is talking to me about mindfulness. And the reason I'm saying that is because he uses the word epiphany, which I love. I would love to reclaim that word. I associate that very strongly with my Christian upbringing. Epiphany, the night of the epiphany. I was raised Catholic. So we don't say epiphany much in Zen communities, but there's a whole bunch of words we use that are all roughly synonymous. Kensho, breakthrough, enlightenment, awakening, insight, penetration, one-pointedness, non-duality. Epiphany is one of those. Aha, eureka, light bulb moment. They're all variations on the theme of, right? When the world suddenly lines itself up in such a way, your heart opens in such a way, the world just got bigger, deeper, you understood something you didn't understand before, but you feel it on sort of a cellular level. Does that make sense? Everybody's had that? It's funny that when it happens kind of suddenly and dramatically that way, when you sort of do see it, it's oftentimes accompanied physically by an inhale. Inspiration. The spirit goes in, inspiration. You literally are informed now by something that was once outside of you. You're inspired. That's what that word means, right? You've just taken a breath in. So as we sat and did Zazen today for 40 minutes, you were inspired many, many, many hundreds of times. Isn't that funny? I just think it's interesting. So, this mud body is clear epiphany. So he's juxtaposing two things. One is very dense and opaque, mud, and one is clear. And boy, does he sound like a Mahayana Buddhist here by refusing to separate those two things. Right? He starts where we all start. This mud body, everybody knows that. Ashes to ashes. This body's made of mud. It's made of the earth. We're consciousness and form. Isn't that exciting? Consciousness and form. Should we identify with the consciousness or should we identify with the mud? Oh, and Zen they're not too. You don't have to make that choice. Isn't that nice? This mud body is clear epiphany. It is knowing itself. It is knowing itself. So the opposite of ignorance, the opposite of delusion, the opposite of not seeing is what we call mindfulness or insight or clarity. To see deeply into, right? To look deeply into. And when we look deep enough into this mud body, clear epiphany, the vehicle for our awakening is this body. It's huge. Huge. It's one of the things that made Buddhism such a departure from the yogic tradition that preceded it. No, this is it right here. These bones, these muscles. This is the vehicle. This is enlightenment. It's right here. It isn't when I adequately suppress the body. It isn't when the body dies and goes away. This is it here. I refuse to separate the lofty idea with this mud body. That's groundbreaking. You guys remember the Buddha story, all the different practices you tried to suppress the body to awaken the spirit, to suppress the body to awaken consciousness, right? When you ignore the body, repress the body, punish the body, then consciousness, da-da-da, that whole split. Very common. All sorts of faith traditions have some sort of variation on this. Well, if the body's bad, then the da-da-da is good, right? That split. And at some point, you just, nope, that doesn't seem to work. Seems like when you punish the body, it hurts. Seems like when you starve it, it dies. I don't know. Maybe it's just me. This isn't working. Maybe this mud body is epiphany. So I love epiphany. I love epiphany. That's a good word for us. So the faith in mindfulness that this talks about to me is faith in our own experience, present moment awareness. Present moment awareness. All of us here, I'm sure, have had at least a small taste of the experience of feeling heavy, dark, bogged down, burdened, probably with afflictive thoughts or afflictive emotion, and we spend a few minutes reconnecting with the body. Where's my breath right now? Where are my bones right now? How am I choosing to balance them? There's my feet on the floor. Coming back, and after a few minutes of doing that, experiencing a little bit of lightness, right? I'm a little less heavy. I'm a little more connected. I'm a little, right? I feel a little more stable. I'm a little less thrown by my life. So when we do that enough, we start to have what we would call faith, trust in mindfulness itself. Are you freaked out right now? Where's your body? Where's your breath? And you remember this because you've done this a bunch. And you know, oh, something happens when I do that. Something happens when I do that. My faith in my ability to return to reality as it is and be okay with it as it is has been verified by my own experience. I've done this a lot. The more of this we do, the more okay we become. The more of this we do, the bigger the difficulty we can be at peace with. These things can be okay. They can be okay. Wow. Just coming back to the awareness of this mud body so often can be a breakthrough, an epiphany. You know, I also like it because it's about the body. It's about the body. And I go into my head like a lot of us do. I use my thoughts as an escape. I use my concepts as a way of withdrawing. I use my explanations as a way of trying to assert control over the world, right? It's more comfortable for me to live in the map of the world than in the actual world. So the invitation to come back, to let go of the conceptual framework and live inside the subtlety of the sensations of breath and the connection to the earth that I feel through the mud body, to experience that as liberative, as freeing, that's the medicine that I need so often. So often when I find myself suffering, it's because of my ideas. I really believe them. I just do. And so many of them are so small and so mean. They're so limited, you know? Do you catch yourself doing that? Like, wow, I just keep repeating that same story over and over about how bad that person is. How am I feeling right now? Oh, I don't know, but I've got a story. That person's really bad. I have another idea. If they went away or were further away from me, I'd feel better. That's my map. I'm just going to stick with it. Oh, no. You feel sort of the impoverishment of that? How much of my experience I'm missing? I'm so far away from my mud body. I so am convinced that my epiphany is going to happen up here. So this mud body, clear epiphany. And he actually goes on to talk a little bit more about it. The second little bit there, angels wish they could move as I move. Is about physicality to me too. I like this one especially because in the Buddhist tradition we have bodhisattvas. A lot of us know the word bodhisattva. We don't talk about angels so much. But we do talk about bodhisattvas, and like all humans, we have a great tendency to separate the material and the spiritual. And we love to think that there are kind of mystical, heavenly, non-earthly beings. And that may or may not be true, I don't know. But what this line does is remind me, wouldn't it be interesting if they thought, oh, to be human? Because I think the shared understanding is, from this point of view, it'd be way much better to be that. Wow, because I remember when I was a kid, like, well, Grandma died, and she's an angel now. Or she's with the angels now. You know, when you die and you lose the body, a better thing happens. You go to the heaven realm or the angel realm, or, you know, you're no longer bound, you are now free. And I was like, oh, I wish I could be that too. Plus, in the Christian tradition, angels are oftentimes presented as having wings, which is, like, super cool, because who doesn't want to fly? I want to be able to fly. And if dying means I grow wings and I can fly around, that sounds pretty sweet to me, frankly. And, of course, you're not troubled by having to go to school or homework or, you know, bossy parents and curfews and all that kind of stuff. There's really no downside to being an angel, right? This is just, the more I think about it, the more increasingly appealing this is sounding. So when he flips it on his head and goes, by the way, all those angels are just wishing they could move the way you do. You're thirsty and you reached for a cup and you picked it up. You're cold and you put on a sweater. You moved the mud body. That matter. You moved matter. You pick up matter. Like, that's how engaged you are. Your consciousness in form. You can do that. You interact with the world that way. Shut the door. Open the door. Call the dog. Pet the dog. Wow. You bet they wish they could move like I do. Yeah, I'm kind of down here rocking this thing. Do I normally think of it that way? No, I'm bored. I'm just going through my life, you know. Unlocking the car door when it's 16 below does not really occur to me as the epiphany of the mud body. And yet he's like, oh, angels are like, oh, look how they, right, it's earth, and yet it's heaven in earth, informing earth, moving. Wow. To feel an emotion, to have a tear escape the eye, and to use a tissue, you know, to wipe it away. What a miracle. I can kind of imagine, if I use my imagination, I can kind of imagine angels going, oh, yeah. Right. That's where it is. That's where it is. So maybe this is sort of those, you know, the grass is always greener thing. And I was a human. Oh, I wish I was an angel. And the angels go, oh, I wish I was a human. I don't know, but I love this. I love it because, of course, it's a poetic image. But it is an assertion. It is an assertion of the primacy and the liberative capacity of physicality itself. Physicality in itself. And again, to go back to basic Buddhism, even our Heart Sutra, form, consciousness, we have the five skandhas, what we call the things that make up the self. The very first one is form, matter, physicality, right? That's a vehicle for liberation. This is awakeness itself. This is awakeness in, this is it, awakeness itself. That's a reassertion of this. Again, we're not leaving out anything. So it isn't, oh, right, when that goes away, then I. Or that part of me that's awake, but not this part. It's when Mumon talked about the one who lacks the third eye of insight, all he's talking about is the third eye is just symbolic of your ability to see two things at once. See two things at once. We don't have to get any fancier than that. You can see two things at once. Oh, yeah, they're really wonderful and they drive me crazy. One thing, right? You don't have to separate those. Yes, I'm amazing and I'm also kind of a jerk. Sounds like you and 7 billion other people. There you go. Can you hold those both? Right? And as simple as that sounds, we actually have a very difficult time doing that. It's very difficult for us not to separate consciousness from form, good from bad, the enemy from the friend. Right? We love to separate those things because, number one, they appear to be true. And number two, it just makes the world simpler and easier to live in. Now I'm back in the map again. So when the Buddha taught that physicality itself, the body itself, going back to mindfulness of the body, the very first thing he taught, mindfulness of breath, the very first thing he taught, mindfulness of emotions, then consciousness. Don't leave those others out. So I think I'm trying to work on my relationship with my mud body. So maybe that's why this feels relevant to me, but A lot of us have a difficult relationship with our mud, don't we? A lot of us have a very difficult time with physicality. We fight with it a lot. So, our transcendence is here. Our epiphany is here. Our liberation is here. Right in the body. So, when I first read this some years ago, by this point in the poem, which is only two lines, by this point in the poem, I was already resisting it and going, oh, he's sort of sweet. But he doesn't tell the truth. You know, Rumi's kind of a goof. For those of you who have read a lot of Rumi, you know he's kind of... he's famously passionate. His awareness is incredibly clear. But it doesn't come out in the measured way we're used to in Zen literature. It's part of why I'm drawn to him, because he provides for me such a nice counterpoint to so much of Zen literature, which feels much more measured, much more sort of emotionally cool, much more sort of considered. Rumi is sort of on fire. And Zazen strikes me as a very on-fire thing to do, which is funny because I know that's in contrast to the fact we sit very still and very, very quiet and we look very dignified and, you know, composed. But I have sat enough Zazen to know if there's 30 people in this room, there are 30 bonfires in this room. And regardless of how, you know, upright and still and Buddha-like they look, you know that inside there's this fire. Of course there is. Of course there is. There should be. That's what we're here to do. And one of the reasons that I found myself resisting that I continue to work with his voice so much is he has this, what sometimes feels almost reckless to me, this kind of reckless faith in original goodness. He just really believes everything's fundamentally okay, that we're fundamentally pure and beautiful and great. We have it in our Zen tradition too. Master Dogen's very first line of Fukan Zazengi: the way is originally pure and all-pervading. The very same message. It's a profound line. The way, the path, existence itself, human life, we can reduce that to, say, Buddhism or Soto Zen Buddhism, but, you know, the way, the thing we're all doing, this thing, it's originally pure, fundamentally pure, and all-pervading. That's the starting point. That's the starting point of Mahayana Buddhism. It's certainly the starting point of Zen. And then he goes on to ask a really important question, which is, well, then why do we need to practice? Which is a really good question. And that was one of his great koans, and Fukan Zazengi is in some ways an answer to that koan. But anyway, for today's purposes, most of us just don't buy it. We love hearing it. You're fundamentally beautiful. You were born pure. You were born whole. You're lacking nothing. We love to hear that. Do we believe it? No, we do not. We really do not. If you think you believe it, look at your life. This is the human condition. It's not unique to these people in this room today. This is the human condition. We love to hear it. We want to believe it. We have a very, very, very difficult time believing it. So by this point in the poem, I'm already kind of half punched out. Because I do what we all do. I make myself a bump. There's the universe, and then there's me. I'm the bump. I like talking about this because I just see it over and over and over and over and over and over and over in my consciousness and the consciousness of my students and the consciousness of people I meet with. There's the universe, and it's beautiful, and it's wonderful, and I trust all of that, and I have faith in its fundamental purity. Oh, and by the way, then there's me. Right? Angels wish they could move as I move. I mean, not me. You. I can see how beautiful you are. You know. Yes, your mud body is clear epiphany. Yes, it is. Mine, on the other hand, I haven't been going to yoga. way too many Christmas cookies. Yeah, no, your mud body is A-okay, but I am pretty muddy, actually. Wow. Oh, but he doesn't let us get away with it, because he's going to move on now into purity. Purity, purity, purity. Purity and courage. And he uses the words. No more poetic images. Purity. And he asks it as a question. At least that's what our translator, Coleman Barks, has done. Purity? Is that what you think you're looking for? Is that what I imagine that I'm looking for? Cherubim babies long for my innocence. You know cherubim, right? The little babies they have in old paintings by like Rubens and stuff, and all the little sort of chubby little happy. It's babies, you guys. You know, the vision of purity. When you hold a newborn in your home, you go, ah, purity, right? We all understand this. Babies. They long for my innocence. That's funny because I've been around quite a while now and I've made loads of mistakes and I'm a hot mess and my da-da-da-da and I've got unpaid mortgage and da-da-da-da and my car wouldn't start. And I think the longer I'm alive, the less pure I get. Right? I start pure, even if I can't accept that as an idea. I'm so far removed from that experience now because I've been so battered and beaten and bruised and blah, 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 blah by life that, again, he's just taking two things you assume to be true and flipping them. The baby longs for you. The angel longs for you. The epiphany is actually your body. See what he's doing there? He's just making sure you understand the disconnect in your thinking. And like a good Buddhist teacher would do, he's showing you the suffering that it causes when you imagine that your purity has been lost. Or even, for some of us, that you never had it. That you never had it. I was raised with the doctrine of original sin, that we are born broken and fundamentally impure, and that we need the intercession of a tradition and various rituals and that kind of stuff to restore us to our state of original purity, and that is contingent upon our behavior going forward. So a lot of us were raised with that. And I would actually offer you the idea that even if you weren't raised with that, you were raised with that. Because you were. It's just the air we breathe. Even if it wasn't packaged to you as, you know, church doctrine, even if you were raised outside of the church, the fundamental belief that we are broken and need fixing, it just seems to be the human condition. It just seems to be. So actually, you know, to meet with somebody, whether it's for tea or coffee or your rally's coming for the holidays, you know, you can kind of do a sociological experiment and play with some of this stuff and go, so, you know, when you look back on your year, how was your year? Oh, 2018's coming up. Oh, what are your aspirations? Cool, yeah, yeah. So are you pure? Actually, you might get smacked for acting that. It almost sounds a little questionable. Are you pure? Did you have a pure year? Will you be pure in 2018? As like my New Year's resolution is to maintain my purity. For 2018, that seems reasonable. It's a very funny word. You can feel how loaded it is, right? I'm making a joke, but you can feel this word is loaded. We have added a lot of energy to this word, pure. Oh, my God. We're going to fight all day about what that means and what constitutes pure and what constitutes impure. And which of that is actions? Which of that is intentions? How about thoughts? How about emotions? Are there impure emotions? How about impulses? Are there pure and impure impulses? I hope this landscape's sounding familiar because we're really, really good at deciding collectively what we consider to be pure and impure in a religious context, in a secular context, in a family context, in my own inside landscape context. I do this all the time. I do this all the time. The challenge, I think, with this is Mumon's third eye idea. The challenge for us is holding the idea of purity along with the idea of impurity. It's really difficult for us to hold both of those because it's so easy for us to fall into one side or to fall into the other. Because we're asked here to hold the idea that there is some part of us that we, in essence, are Buddha nature, right? Consciousness and form. The way is originally perfect and all-pervading. And that never, ever, 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 ever goes away, nor could it. And at the same time, we make very careful decisions about behaviors that we cultivate and thoughts that we want to repeat and emotions that we generate because some things cause us suffering and some things don't. So it's really, really interesting to think I have responsibility and yet maybe not shame. Am I defined by my past actions? Do they define me? Do I have responsibility for them? Or do I allow them to just cut me off from my original nature? If I've done a bad thing, am I cut off from my original nature? That's like a really good question to... Isn't that a really good question? I'm not answering it for you, I'm just asking. If you've done a really bad thing, are you that really bad thing? Because you can't really answer yes, but you can't quite answer no. Does it define you? Does it limit you? Did it happen? Is it real? These are really good questions. Yeah. Wow. I'm not really sure where to land. And like most people, I'm much more attached to, meaning I repeat more often, the list of bad things that I've done than the list of good things I've done. That's not true for all of us, but the majority of us are pretty good at, like, oh, name your top 10 sins. Oh, yeah, I got those locked and loaded. The time I, right? I'm much quicker to attach my ego identity to that list than I am. What are the 10 best things you've ever done? I don't even have a list. I don't even know what that would be. I don't know. I rescued a bunny from the window well at Aslan last year. I was very happy about that. That really gave me a really, really good day, but I didn't define myself by it, and I didn't carry myself into the future knowing I'm the bunny rescuing guy, because it just sort of happened once, and I'm just, oh, there's a bunny in my window well, so I went and got it. But that map goes away pretty quickly, and I'm much quicker to go back to my original list of 10 things I've done bad. So purity is a difficult thing. It's a very difficult thing for us. The reason I think this is relevant, and there's way more here than we can ever have time to explore today, but, you know, in Japanese Soto Zen, the tradition we practice here, doing zazen, right, doing our seated meditation, is always seen in some way or another as going back to, returning to, touching an original state of being, of just perception. And it's so pure. It's talked about as being pure or clear or transparent. It's sometimes talked about as being luminous. When it's not filtered by all of my perceptions, all of my habits, all of my patterns, all of my preferences, but it's just perception itself. That's purity in Zen. They trust that's the nature of your mind originally. And by original, they didn't mean all the years when you were born, although that's true too. It means right now originally. It's happening now. So when we teach people mindfulness, at least I like to go out of my way to say, I'm not teaching you this new magic way of working with your brain that we've just invented a little while ago and Google's decided is groovy and so you should insert it into your life as a new skill set, right? This is the way your mind is working right now. Are you aware of the cloth against your skin? Oh, well, I am now that you said it. Yeah, I didn't just invent cloth or sensation or skin. That was happening already. You were already aware of something without any judgment, without any analysis, without any preference, without any I want more of or I want less of. There was no greed. There was no delusion. Just simple awareness. Just simple awareness as being fundamentally pure. Just awareness. It's luminous. I use the metaphor a lot of a mirror. Just reflects. Just reflects. No opinions about anything it's reflecting. The mirror is pure. It doesn't pick and choose. I'll take the babies, but none of the old people. Don't like them. Take all the Buddhists, but none of the Christians. Don't like them. Take all the da-da-da, but not the da-da, right? It just reflects what's there. Purity. Purity. It is unstained, we would say, right? Just the way your consciousness is, right? Fundamentally unstained. So you can't hear that noise anymore. That noise is gone. We all agree it happened. I clapped my hands. But your hearing is unstained by that sound. You don't hear it anymore. It's gone. You've heard a trillion things in your life. You can't hear any of them now. All the horrible moods that you've had, the sadness, the heartbreak, the despair, the anger, they passed. They left you in a state of emotional purity before the arising of, right? All the thoughts that you've had, the busiest mind in the world, the monkeys that show up during zazen, right? Right now? Where are they? That thought that wouldn't leave you alone a half an hour ago is gone. Did it leave a mark on your mind? No. Fundamental, right? Purity. Isn't that fascinating? So that's why we use the metaphor of the sky. For mind in Buddhism, you know, your mind is like the sky, and no matter how dramatic the clouds are, no matter how stormy and hurricaney and tornadoy, this is the Midwest, tornadoy and dark, pretty dramatic. Are those things really happening? Yes, they are. Do you need to respond to them skillfully? Yes, you do. When they're gone, do they leave a mark? No, they don't. The worst storm that has ever happened in the history of this planet didn't leave even one mark on the sky. nor did the coolest, biggest, whitest, poofiest, friendliest cloud ever that looked exactly like a bunny. And it was just the sweetest thing in the universe, and when that poofed, it didn't leave a mark. Fundamental purity. The good and the bad arising, passing away. Arising, passing away. And you are that upon which it's all reflected. Right? The mirror. That's kind of cool, don't you think? Something kind of cool about that. So, let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. That's our great Zen teacher in the Song of the Grass Roof Hermitage. Shito implores us to let go of hundreds of years and relax completely. Open your hands and walk innocent. That's his Zazen instruction. Isn't that great? Just sit down and straighten your spine and cross your legs and just let go of hundreds of years. Just let go of hundreds of years. Relax completely. And then you'll open your hands, right? An image of complete surrender, complete allowing. And you'll walk innocent. That's how innocent you are right now. Inspiration. You're brand new right now. Brand new right now. Completely innocent. And at the same time, the result of every decision you've ever done, ever made, everything, every thought. It's a fascinating relationship we have with karma in this tradition, but starting at a reminder of purity, I think, is really helpful for us. It makes us more responsible, actually, for our actions and not less, if that makes sense. So, okay, I'm running out of time here. Courage. I'll talk about courage a little bit. Courage, he says. Courage, you said this morning when you made this poem yours. Armies of demons flee my uplifted hand. Oh, that's just cool. That's just so Star Wars, isn't it? Drama. Yeah, see, he's just into the drama. Armies of demons flee my uplifted hand. Oh, I love it. Does he have a weapon in that hand? No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. You don't need it either. What I love about this is, you know, the armies of demons, everybody knows the armies of demons. Everybody knows their demons. We know what those are. Some of them we all share. They're the human demons. Some of them are very personal. We have our favorites that love to visit. But also, all of us have experienced in our lives moments of being very, very terrified, very, very frightened, very, very scared of doing something and doing it anyway. So in that moment, what's happening? I'm scared of doing this. I'm doing it anyway. Right? We know which part of that is the demon. It's the fear. These bad things are going to happen to you. They're going to think these things about you. Horrible. Right? That's what demons do. You know, they try their best, poor guys, but they're really simpletons. You know, demons aren't very smart. They're not very sophisticated. They really just have one or two messages, and they just sort of say them over and over and over, right? Arr, 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 arr. Like, I get it. You're going to bite me, and that's the thing. That's really all you've got. Is, do you have anything else? No, pretty much. Arr. Okay, cool. Well, arr. Okay. So if you're just telling me, oh, you should be scared, you should be scared, you should be scared, and then I do it anyway, what just happened to you? Poof. I mean, you might show up again 5 seconds from now. In fact, chances are you're pretty tenacious. I get that. But wow, that really is all you've got is arr, arr, arr. That's all you've got. And so just me doing the thing I'm scared of doing, poof. I mean, really, poof, right? So every single person in this room has done that. And the Three Temptations of Buddha, one of my favorite Buddhist myths, is, you know, he's sitting under the tree there, and because of the power of his wisdom and his compassion, all the arrows that are shot at him and all the armies of demons that are assembled, poof, they flee or they turn into flowers. How cool is that? Turning into flowers, by the way, is just awesome. That's just awesome. That probably wouldn't work in a Star Wars movie. That's a little too roomy. But just like, you know, poof, flowers. Oh, that's like such a great magic trick, you know? That's such a great magic trick. I think that's why magicians pull out stuff like bunnies and doves and not like, I don't know, lizards or something. Just like, it's the same poof, but what it poofs into is really cool. That all those arrows turned into flowers or tea. They could have turned into tea. I would have been happy about tea. So this happens all the time. Armies of demons, armies of demons, armies of demons. I love, again, the power of the image, but again, the hardest thing for all of us is to live into what he's describing to us. When Rumi is describing our mud body as epiphany, when Rumi is describing our movements as being divine, our everyday movements as being divine, when he's describing our somehow fundamental, somehow unassailable purity, when he's describing the thousands of little tiny courageous things we do every single day that send tides of demons running, I think the hard part for us is trying to live into believing this, to actually touching it, to actually touching that. I think Zazen actually helps hugely with this. When I start going, well, this is mindfulness. This is me overcoming fear by simply noticing it, befriending it, moving. That's all I actually need to do here. This isn't magic powers. This is actually the magic power of just being a human. There's nothing here I wasn't born with. Everybody was born with a mud body. Everybody was born with exactly what he's talking about. There isn't anything apart about any of these qualities. So, in Zazen, we are taught when fear arises, because fear arises during Zazen, in case you didn't notice that. I'm assuming you've all noticed. Anger arising, fear arising, boredom arising, grief arising, happiness arising, contentment arising, bliss arising. It all arises, right? It's an empty vessel. So everything gets a chance to fill it. When fear shows up, aha! Now courage is possible. I cannot have courage without fear. So fear arises. I'm really scared of that conversation. I'm really scared of that person. They've got power over me and they've always made me nervous. I'm scared. Aha! Courage is possible right now. Wow, if courage is possible, growth is possible. I can get bigger here. I can get bigger now. So fear is just like a light on your dashboard going off that says, you can get bigger right now if you want. Here's permission to get bigger. You want to get bigger? You can. Right? You can. That's all the demons are doing, is delivering you the message, you can get bigger right now. Right now you have a chance. You have a chance to grow because you chose courage. You noticed fear, you saw an opportunity for courage, and courage gave you an opportunity for growth. You can leave this circumstance a little bigger. Here's your chance. Right? That's why Tim says that Mara and all of his demons are just Buddha in disguise. It's all just a game, you know. Wow, growth is possible. And we need all the help we can get with this awakening project, this thing called being a human. So I hope Rumi's stuff is helpful to you today. The way I've unpacked it is just the way I happen to unpack it today. I hope there's something in there for you. But either way, you know, spend some time with this. Cut it out of the program and put it on your fridge or on your steering wheel or something and sit with it. You know, sit with it at the red light and chant it. Get it in your bones. See what it has for you. Because I need... And this is the reason for Sangha I think we all need, but I'll speak for myself. I need lots of support. I need a lot of help. And I get support and encouragement by people like Rumi and people like you and people like my teachers because they have all found themselves, like we all do, on the top of a 100-foot pole. They know what it's like to feel scared the way I feel scared, to try to reframe fear is an opportunity for growth, just like I am trying to. And they all, on some level, at some point, chose to do the wildly insane thing at the top of the 100-foot pole called taking a step. They choose to do the one thing. And I know you've done that too. And I thank you for that. Because I see you, and I need that support. I need that help. So thank you. Thank you. You came across town today in really, really cold weather on New Year's Eve. Thank you. All right. Thank you. I appreciate your time this morning. We have a few minutes. If anybody has any questions or insights, some people I'm sure know this poem. Maybe this took you someplace different than it did me. Steve.
Okay, so original purity... correspondent, but the Bodhisattva way is dealing with unliberated aspects of being.
Yes, right.
And that seems to be the agenda for most or all of life. So, and given that, I mean, just kind of a Pascalian wager, why wouldn't you deal with your own bad karma as opposed to becoming Peter and dealing with someone else's bad karma? Because you're going to, basically, the agenda is bad karma or confinement or imprisonment. So you might as well eat, drink, and be merry and then deal with the after effects as a, your own as opposed to someone else's.
Are they different?
Well, that's my point. I mean, because if you're a, you know, in non-duality, right? So you're a, you don't know whose bad karma you're dealing with. So a Pascalian wager, you might as well eat, drink, and be merry and deal with your own. Because you're going to be dealing with bad karma no matter what in the non-dual. Cynical, but I mean...
Yeah, I guess the only place I really go with that is at some point, this is actually a turning point for me, at some point I stopped asking whose karma this was. Like, this thing is on my plate. Is this my deal, or is this just cultural, or is this my family, or is this part of my gender or my race, or is this part of, like, I'm just going, it's on my plate. Here it is. End of story. My karma and the karma of other beings can't possibly be two. Therefore, it's all mine. I mean, also, therefore, none of it's mine, but the response around... the thing I like about the anchor in Buddhism always being, where is the liberative potential here? Where is the possibility of transforming what exists as suffering into what transforms into what exists as joy? Oh, well then, the question about whose this is isn't liberative. How do I respond to this with wisdom and compassion? That is liberative. So there's where my energy goes. Because I certainly wouldn't posit a theory about the universe and about how karma actually works. My understanding of that is much less important than how do I respond to the arising of suffering now in a way that is wise and compassionate and helps to transform it. I don't. Is that helpful? Is that helpful to you? You're asking a really good question there, but is that in any way helpful?
Well, I mean, you seem like a much better, wiser guy than me. But I thought I'd throw it out.
I don't know about that even a little bit. Does anybody else have anything today? Please, Chris.
Something that you brought up earlier on that you don't feel talked down to by Rumi, you feel like you're feeling, you feel you got something together.
Yeah.
You brought up something that I believe Andrea said in recent weeks, because she was one of the few here that got to hang around and be friends with Katagiri.
Yeah, yeah.
And she said that in some of his working on translating some of the Japanese texts, it might not have been Andrea, but I'm pretty sure it was, said that he found instead of using the word student in a Dharma talk situation, that his, the way it's been translated for quite some time, she said that Katagiri started using the word the listener.
Oh, I've heard this idea.
I think it was Andrea that brought up that Katagiri started feeling that the word the listener was more accurate coming from the Japanese to describe the people in attendance at a good Dharma talk.
Yeah, I've heard this.
If it wasn't Andrea, it might be, it might have been Ben. But it was Katagiri. I just placed his own Katagiri that came up with that distinction. And also, by the way, the value of the Sangha really hit home for me, because it was probably over 20 years ago that I read Philip K. Dick's Futurism Zen, and then went on, or wasn't just detached by something, my own self-image was my attachment to my suffering. This is what I do. And I went on for decades in my life where, you know, Christopher is his attachment to his suffering. It was this place of like, oh, now I'm starting to change. Cool, I'm these people.
Yeah.
And then somewhere in the back of my head, I heard Philip Capello, though I never met him before, say, hey, look, I tried.
it's very healthy, isn't it, to bump up against each other?
Yeah, yeah. Well, Capello might have then said, look, I put a lot of work into this book, but this book isn't liberation, okay? This is just an arrow pointing the way.
Yeah. Thank you. That's one of my favorites, by the way. I love that book. Yeah. Okay, well, I wish we had more time together in the warm Zendo, but tea. We have tea following the talk. So, Katie, please.